Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point.
We're supposed to pursue the truth, but you have stacked the deck against the truth.
It was demagogic and in too many places just untruthful.
This was the largest audience to ever witness an inauguration, period.
Trump said something untrue in public every day for the first 40 days of his presidency.
And the fake news refused to call it, right?
You choose the worst intent of people's words.
No.
Like when I say that I believe something.
You're saying it's a falsehood, and Sean Spicer, our press secretary, gave alternative facts.
No, you, George. You don't want to hear a goddamn thing you have to say.
We never even know what to believe anymore.
We never know what to believe anymore. Is that true? I mean, let's just sit with that for a moment. Because no question about truth can be asked without invoking the concept itself. Truth is one of those words, one of those concepts. It's so central to science, to morality, to faith, trust, communication, our very understanding of what reality is. So how we perceive truth, what we believe about it, those things guide our every moment as individuals who walk through this world. They can also determine the course of history for all of humankind overall. So this week, we're going to be launching a special four-part series looking at truth. What is it? What have we believed about it across history and cultures? How do our brains process it? And how do the powerful manipulate it? In other words, we want to step back and explore the truth about truth. Now, we're doing this series in collaboration with a nonprofit journalism organization called The Conversation. And here to help us kick things off is Beth Daly, editor and general manager of The Conversation US. Hello, Beth.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks for having me.
I can verify to everyone that it is true that you are sitting across from me at the table here at On Point. I couldn't resist. I'll stop making those jokes, but I just couldn't resist. But first of all, tell us, what is The Conversation?
Yeah. So The Conversation started in Australia in about 9 years ago. And the whole idea was to extract knowledge, evidence-based knowledge, not from journalists who were just sort of disappearing, but from academics who study a subject forever. And so here at The Conversation US, we democratize knowledge. We reach into academia and find researchers on particularly every topical subject you can imagine, from Trump to why zebras have stripes, to any question you have. And we publish 10 to 12 stories a day that go out on the Associated Press Wire, goes to hundreds of papers across the U.S., where the academics get the byline. They're the reporters. So instead of having a newsroom of, you know, 100 reporters or 20, we have hundreds of thousands of academics who write for us.
And rather than it being written in the language of scholarly journals, for example, it's written in very accessible language so that the rest of us can learn from these scholars. That seems to be one of the defining features.
Right. So that's where we come into it. So the academics pitch us every day, and our team of about 19 editors who are subject specific experts in their field work with those academics rigorously to come up with a story at the end of the day that is readable and digestible to most people.
So, Beth, why do you think the work that The Conversation is doing in this particular approach is so important right now?
You know, we're facing a time right now where, like, the reason why we're doing the show on truth is that you can't really tell what is true and what's not. So what we're doing is reaching into academia, the people with evidence-based knowledge who actually have studied a subject the most intensely, and taking that out and bringing it to the public and telling the world, like, this is evidence-based work. This is something you can believe. It's not opinion. It's explanatory journalism. It's sometimes expert commentary and simple analysis. And It's very powerful.
Yeah. So, folks, just to be clear, the scholars that you'll be hearing from in our various conversations about truth this week, their work has appeared in the conversation, and there'll be links to all of that at our website, onpointradio.org. Now, Beth, a couple of weeks ago, we were all sitting together trying to hash out, like, what would be a great series to start off with? And we had lots of big ideas. I mean, I think we chose possibly one of the biggest ones of them all. I mean, what are we trying to accomplish by looking into various aspects of truth and what it is?
I think this was your idea, actually.
It was. I was.
But it's a big idea, right? So why not tackle a show on truth with the people who know it the best? And that's the scholars who study it in a variety of interdisciplinary ways, you know? And it's an amazing subject, and it's not going to be done in 4 days, obviously.
No, but hopefully we'll make a strong start out of it. I mean, my hope was that this is one of those issues which seems under attack from all sides, but is so fundamental to, as I said in the beginning, our very understanding of reality. So looking at what truth is from various disciplines, I thought maybe we'll sort of help us grapple with where we are right now.
It's fascinating because as journalists, we all constantly say, you know, we're producing fact-based, truthful information. But the truth is that people have different perceptions of the truth based on their values, beliefs, and many other things. And that's what I know.
Exploring. Well, Beth Daly is editor and general manager of The Conversation U.S., and we are doing this week's series on the truth about truth in collaboration with The Conversation. So, Beth, thank you so much for helping us get things started.
Thank you.
All right. So today we're going to be taking a look at how ancient cultures grappled with this question of truth. And joining me now in the studio is Joel Christensen. He's a professor of classical studies at Brandeis University and author of The Many-Minded Man, The Odyssey, Psychology, and the Therapy of Epic. Joel, welcome to On Point.
Thank you.
And thank you for helping us get us started on this exploration about the truth about truth. So you are a scholar of the classics, particularly of the ancient Greeks.
Yeah, I specialize really in Homeric poetry and early Greek poetry in general. I do a lot of work in myth and language.
So what was the ancient Greek word for truth?
I think what is fascinating is that there's not just one. All right, so let's start out with one that's probably the most famous, and that's aletheia. And people who watch HBO might know it from the alethiometer that Lyra has that tells her the truth. It's literally a measurer of the truth. But the word aletheia, it's what's called an alpha privative compound. It negates the root. And the root is the same root as in the river of forgetfulness, lethe. So aletheia literally means something more like the unforgettable.
Right, unforgettable.
The unforgettable. So something that cannot be forgotten. Or must always be remembered. There's this thing that happens in early Greek language where you say the opposite of a thing as a compliment. So if in English I said to you, you know, he's not unattractive, you would say that's an insult. But in ancient Greek, if you say someone's not unattractive, it means they're attractive because you don't want to be so arrogant as to say before the gods and all of mankind that someone is absolutely a thing.
Okay.
So when you say something is unforgettable, it means it's memorable and you must not forget it.
So does that mean that at least one ancient Greek conception of truth was centered around actually our perception of it? I mean, if our memory of truth was so key to the very definition of this particular word.
Well, it depends on who's doing the remembering and who has access to the memory.
I have a feeling that it depends is going to be the answer to a lot of questions this week.
You could just summarize the whole week that way. Right? So in the piece I wrote for The Conversation, there are two lines that come from the beginning of Hesiod's Theogony, which really help to encapsulate some of these issues. Now, Hesiod's Theogony is a poem that tells a story of the creation of the universe and the creation of the gods. So if you start to read it, you think, all right, I'm going to hear a nice story about where Zeus came from. But before you even get there, there's a whole framing session where the poet or the narrator speaks about how he came to be able to tell the story of the gods. And the story he tells is that he was a country bumpkin tending his sheep. The muses just appeared to him and said, hey, country bumpkin, we know how to say many lies that sound like the truth, and we know how to speak the truth when we want to. And that's how he prefaces like the entire poem that's supposed to be the story of the creation of the universe. And what's fascinating about this is that there are actually two words for truth in there. The word for lie is easy. It's pseudeia. It's the same thing we have in roots like pseudonym or pseudoscience. But the first root used for truth is the word etymon. And we get our word etymology from it. And at its base, it's something that's obsessed or concerned with origins and authenticity or authority. Right? And so the opposite from that, if we're going to define by opposites, would be a counterfeit.
Okay.
Okay. And then the other one, aletheia, is the unforgettable. So in this little preface, we have two aspects of truth, right? Or two ways of defining it. One is something that cannot be forgotten because it's eternal.
Uh-huh.
And the other is something that's authoritative because it's ancient and foundational.
So eternal and foundational.
Right. But then we have to add the depends on it because the riddle is that the muses know the difference between truth and fiction, but human beings don't.
Uh-huh.
Right? So the very person who's telling the story of the creation of the universe, the poetic persona in this point, is saying, I was told this story could or could not be true. The muses know, but I don't. And so when I teach this text and think about it and write about it, the first thing to try to understand is, why would you preface a story in this way? And what does this mean?
So what's your answer to that?
My answer is it's complicated. But I think it works on multiple levels. Right? So one, I think it's sort of a clever disclaimer, right? Which is that you may hear something different in this story than you're accustomed to, but don't worry about it because it's not my fault.
Okay.
And I think that's important because we have to realize what ancient Greece was like. First of all, Greeks didn't call themselves Greeks until after they fought the Persians. Right. So for hundreds of years before Herodotus, who wrote the story of the Persian Wars, the Greeks didn't have a word for all of them as a collective. They're a bunch of independent city-states and polities that spoke different dialects and had very different cultural practices. And what's important about Homer and Hesiod is they represent what we call sort of pan-Hellenic culture, or values that are espoused by lots of different groups, but not necessarily represented by one single one.
Interesting. Well, we are talking this hour about truth. It's part one of our special four-part series this week, where we're going to take a look at this concept from a lot of different angles. Today, we're looking back into history about how ancient cultures answered the question about what is truth. We'll talk a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today is part one of our special four-part series where we grapple with the question of what is truth. This is a special series we're doing in collaboration with The Conversation, the nonprofit journalism project. And today we're looking at how ancient cultures, at least a couple of them, answered this question about what is truth. And I'm joined by Joel Christensen, professor of classical studies at Brandeis University. So Joel, part of my role this hour will be to be like that annoying student in your lecture who keeps raising her hand and being like, I don't quite get it. So did the ancient Greeks, did they see truth even given its multiple definitions that you talked about, as something that was divine? Was it discernible? I mean, what was it?
Well, one thing is that I think it's really hard for us to say that the ancient Greeks believed one thing, right? And I think that the multiple answers they have to the truth is really both a reflection of that and sort of what coalesces around their definition of it later on. But I'm glad I don't think you're the annoying student. In fact, that's the best student to have in class because chances are everybody else is unclear, but they're just habituated to not ask questions. So the answer is in the second part of what I was going to say about Hesiod's comments.
Okay.
And that's that I think in what the Muses say about truth, there are theological as well as metaphysical components. Right? And so the metaphysical is what is the universe made of and you know how can I access it? And they're asserting that truth exists and that it's a thing. And by being aletheia, it can't change, right? It's always there. It's unforgettable. But at the same time, by being etymoisin or being original or authentic, it goes way back. Right? And so there is a thing called the truth. And this sort of crisis at the beginning of Theogony, which I treat as a playful riddle, really anticipates later Greek approaches to the truth as well. Right? Right. So the one most listeners might be familiar with is sort of Platonic ideals. So Socrates' insistence that there is truth out there, it's just human beings don't have access to it. And what's really happening is that the Platonic dialogues are reacting to a debate, a dialogue about the truth that goes back into archaic Greek poetry. And so they were what we call pre-Socratic philosophers like Xenophanes who wrote in poetry like Homer or Hesiod's who insisted there was a real thing called the truth and it had to do with an eternal God. Uh-huh. Right? So from the beginning, there's this connection between divinity and truth that has poetry as its mediator, which I think is critical. One of the things we often fail to understand about the ancient world is that poetry was the language of law and science as well as what we might now call literature and religion. So if you went to the oracle to get a prophecy, she would utter the same meter as Homeric or Hesiodic poetry. And they would record laws in the same way. And so there's not this sort of divide between poetry, creative arts, and science or logic and philosophy that you would think of in the modern day.
Right.
And so to go back to the Hesiod bit, the reason it's critical as an introduction is I think it's also about interpretation. Right? It's saying we don't know what is true or what isn't. Like, it's a positive statement of what I'd like to call epistemic humility, right? We don't have the knowledge to judge whether or not a thing is true. And this comes up again later in the sort of Socratic dictum that the wise man is the one who admits what he doesn't know. But when I teach how to interpret Greek poetry, what I focus on from this introduction is that it's telling us to make sense of the details as they exist, to listen to the story, to look at the whole before you make a judgment about what truth effecticity is. It's saying take truth aside for a moment because you don't have access to it. Instead, look at the story.
Interesting. Now, what time period are we talking about here?
So that's a whole other can of worms. But people tend to date Hesiodic and Homeric poetry between the 8th and 6th century BCE.
Okay.
I like to think of it as living on a bit longer than that.
Okay. The reason why I ask is in a lot of what you say – I was doing my homework about this last night. It sounds there. It's echoes of, for example, what ancient Hindu scripture says about truth. And I was referring back to the Bhagavad Gita from roughly 5th century BCE, where Krishna tells Arjuna that basically he is truth, and what truth is it's the very essence of all that is, right? The smell of the soil, the brilliance of the light of the moon. But then if you go back even further to the Vedas, which I think are like 12th century ish. I mean, it can be plus or minus many centuries on either side. The fundamental Hindu notion of that there is a supreme unifying truth that is the glue that holds all the universe together, and that most of us, like you were saying, that the Greeks said, asterisks on the Greeks, that we cannot understand. But perhaps if we work hard enough, we might be able to. I mean, there are echoes there, aren't there?
Absolutely. I don't think the echoes are accidental. And there are two ways to think about them. One is that ancient Greek is really closely related to Sanskrit, right? So much so that their verbal systems almost completely overlap. If you transliterate, you can see it. Right, so they're really close. And of the what we call Indo-European language families, the Greek and the sort of Indic trees split off even later than, say, they did from the Italic branches. Right? So there's some closeness there in sort of language and thought. But there's also something that I think we discount these days for many reasons, which is the cross-pollinization that's going on in the Eastern Mediterranean at a very early period. Prior to what's called the Bronze Age collapse, which may or may not have been as much of a collapse as we think, so around the 12th century, there was heavy trading and interrelation between cultures all throughout the Mediterranean. So their ideas were influencing one another. And the Greeks were especially invested in Asia Minor, which was a crossroads of many cultures. And we have this idea of progress that makes us flatten out history and not understand how embedded and networked the ancient world was. So we know that there were deep relationships, trading relationships between cultures of the Eastern Mediterranean and India. Right? So we have multiple connection points for influence over time, the sort of a genetic language thought connection, but also sort of room for reintegration over time. And one of the big things that happens in what's called in around the 6th century is what's called the rationalizing revolution, which, again, it's a bit of misnomer. But basically, there were tons of Greeks living in Asia Minor. They engaged with cultures from all over, Persians, Egyptians, and then they moved back, right? Because the Persians moved in, there were political alliances and conflicts, and there's a great wave again westward from Asia Minor, where we get what we call the birth of Greek philosophy. We get Thales, the scientist, that guy Xenophanes hails from there. And most of their ideas are actually traceable to the Eastern Mediterranean. And so one of the things that's frustrating for me as someone who teaches about the past is that we have a fiction that was developed post-Renaissance, which is that there's this thing called the Greek miracle,
right,
which is actually not a thing, right? And it's mostly a result of multiculturalism, right? Of the crossroads and the engagement of different beliefs and languages and peoples in the Eastern Mediterranean, and then bringing it back under political pressure to Italy and to the West.
Yeah.
Right? So I think that's another point where you get all these ideas flowing back. And one thing, when you talked about the essence, mm-hmm. I like that from early Hinduism, a later Greek word that's used in philosophy all the time for reality and truth is ta'on. We get our word ontology from it, so the study of existence, and it means literally that which is.
Mm.
Right, so it's the same sort of formation as essence is in English.
Wow. So
sorry.
No, there's so many questions. I actually got lost in my own train of thought in listening to what you were saying here. So I will get my mind back on track here. So let's turn to our listeners.
All right.
Because they've got some really terrific questions. Let's go to Roger, who's calling from Crozet, Virginia. Roger, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm not sure where to start with a question. But I guess, so based on my approach to things, I guess I can make the question, why don't more people go about it like this? I figure there are things that we do know the truth about, and there are things we don't know the truth about. And then there's kind of these three buckets, one that we're probably never going to know the truth about, afterlife, right? Nobody can really know, but the Earth does orbit the sun. The moon does orbit the Earth. And so there are things like that. And then, you know, you can make statements about what our president is or isn't. Mm. But before the election, I thought, because I was aware of what Hitler had sounded like to his people, you know, before Trump ever won the primary, I thought, this guy sounds like Hitler. and I Googled it, and it came up with just a whole bunch of stuff. And I did a screenshot and posted that on Facebook and said, like, never again, evil will not rule the earth. but I was wrong.
Yeah. Well, Roger, I'm going to take it back from you there because I want to turn back to Joel Christensen with something you said. Thank you so much for your call, Roger. Joel, one of the earlier things that Roger was talking about, like just the even... now that we have the scientific knowledge that the moon rotates orbits around the Earth and the Earth orbits around the sun, that was hard won knowledge that is a scientific truth now that was obviously cost the lives of many of early scientists in the Renaissance and pre-Renaissance period. But let me just ask you the question I wanted to turn to you, Joel, with is. You know, and just hearing what Roger was saying, that there are certain things that we accept as true now, right? Was that kind of certainty something that the people who made up ancient Greece, did they possess that certainty?
Sometimes.
Okay.
Right. All right. So one of the things that I try to emphasize when teaching the ancient world is that, you know, in ancient Greece, it's not a text-based sort of revelatory system, right? So access to firm truth is often dependent upon political organizations and ideas about human hierarchies. So we have, you know, for the most part in the world now, we have text-based religious beliefs, right? And there's an authority you can appeal to, and there are traditions of interpreting that authority. And that has a real impact on the way we approach the world and the way we find authority in it, right? I think the interesting thing he asked there is, you know, why don't people believe facts, right? Why don't people believe these things we take to be true?
Right.
And so it's true that most of us do accept that the Earth rotates around the sun. But what's also true is that we don't understand how gravity works, right? So what does that mean, right? And what does it mean if we don't all experience gravity in the same way? And so I'm taking us back now to a division of philosophy called the Epicureans.
Mm-hmm.
And Epicurus, who's usually opposed to the Stoics and Epictetus, has this great analogy that I find really useful. He says, look, we experience the world through very different senses, through five different senses, and we can't actually judge the veracity of what our eyes see with our ears because that quality of information is not accessible to our ears. And he goes through and he says, so the best we can do as individuals is when there's a thing that we can verify as being real to our multiple senses and we can accept it as real. So if we take that up a bit, we aggregate it to human beings as a group. We can agree that things are real when we all can communicate with each other and talk about our experiences of them. But where multiplicity comes in and where diversity really matters is that we all have different bodies.
Uh-huh.
And what Epicurus also notes is that our experiences of the world and our memories of it change the way we interpret our senses. So who you are in the world based on gender or race or religion actually changes the way you sense the world.
Right.
Right? And so what I like to combine that with is modern memory studies. There's this guy named Martin Conway who talks about the way we create our memories of the world and how this creates our sense of self. And he recognizes that there are two main forces in our selections of the facts in the world in accordance with the stories we tell about ourselves. One is correspondence. That's when something happens in the world and what we remember of it is what other people would remember. So there's a correspondence between fact and memory. The other thing, the other force is coherence. And this is when the memories we select or keep are those that cohere with or match the story we want to tell about ourselves, whether we're heroes or villains or what roles we play. Now, the reason this is important to the last question is that we almost always, as human beings, select facts and memories based on the story we already want to believe. And other memory scientists like Mark Turner in his book, The Literary Mind, have persuasively argued that stories shape the way we see the world before anything else. So when we're talking about different viewpoints of the world, our experiences of life and what we believe already is true about the world selects the memories that we make moment to moment, which influences the things that we accept as fact.
So what we're talking about here, to be clear, Joel, is not reality but truth, right? I mean, I think that's an important distinction to make. And you know, to your point about how even this notion that every individual has their own truth, and we discern that through these internal biochemical narratives, that made me want to ask you just quickly, narrative seems to be – truth as narrative seems to be a key thing here in terms of what you're talking about insofar as what it is and even how it was communicated, because you said earlier that even laws and science in ancient Greece were done through verse, right? So, I mean, is the idea that truth is a story central here?
I mean, so I think the idea is that our consciousness – and our brains depend on narrative connections and causal and relationships of causality that exist prior to when we start to interpret a story. Right? So I think narrative is there and how we structure facts in the world that makes sense. Like it's a basic sort of observation of psychological science that when confronted with facts that don't fit the world as we see it, we tend to ignore them. Right. I think in Douglas Adams' books, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, he called this somebody else's problem. Yeah. Right. And you just ignore it. It just goes somewhere else. Right. So I think you're right there. And, you know, there's a schism in philosophy based on this very issue, whether or not our perceptions can even get to external reality or truth, and whether or not that there is an external reality or truth separate from our perceptions. Right. And this is the line between Stoics and Epicureans. And so the central issue Plato was concerned with in his early dialogues.
Well, we are grappling this hour with the question of how ancient cultures viewed or defined what truth is. It's part one of our special series examining truth. We're going to come back and talk about how the question of truth was answered in Islam. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. You're listening to part one of our special four-part series, Grappling with the Truth About Truth. We're going to take a look at four different aspects of what truth is, and we're doing this series in collaboration with the nonprofit journalism organization, TheConversation.com. And today we're taking a look at how some ancient cultures defined and thought about what truth is and what we can learn about that. We're definitely going to ask that question in a couple of minutes. Joel Christensen is with us. He's a professor of classical studies at Brandeis University. And I'd like to bring into the conversation now Mustafa Akyol. Mustafa is a senior fellow at the Cato Institute's Center for Global Liberty and Prosperity and a contributing opinion writer for the New York Times. He's a scholar of Islamic theology, history, and jurisprudence, author of the forthcoming book titled Reopening Muslims' Minds for Reason, Freedom, and Tolerance. Mustafa, welcome to On Point.
Thanks, Meghna. It's great to be on the show. Thanks for having me.
So, I mean, obviously it's asking about like how does any culture or religious tradition define truth is a big question. So let me just narrow it down to start off with you here. If there were a particular individual in Islamic tradition or Islamic history that you would say, study this person's writing and thinking to help to understand Islam and this notion of truth, who would that be?
Sure. I mean, first of all, I should say that for many Muslims, when you ask what is truth, both in history and today, from the conservatives, at least today, you would get the answer, well, truth is established by revelation, period. God gave us scripture and that is truth. But when you ask, okay, how do we know the scripture is correct in the first place? Or why do we believe it in the first place? Then you get into discussions about justifying that. And then reason comes to the fore. So the primacy of reason, at least, is acknowledged by some Muslims in history. And to come to back to your question, I think the most interesting figure in Islamic history in that sense was, to me, the greatest philosopher in the history of Islam. It was Ibn Rushd, also known as Averroes in the West, who was a 12th century Cordoban philosopher who interpreted Aristotle from an Islamic point of view and synthesized Greek thought, especially Aristotle, with his belief in Islam. And he had a great impact on European thought as well. And I think he has some interesting insights about how do we approach truth that are very relevant to some of our contemporary issues in the world today about facts, alternative facts, and so on and so forth. So I'll be happy to explain that a little bit if you will.
Yeah, sure. But first of all, tell us, describe a little bit about how he synthesized Aristotelian and Islamic thought together. What did that look like?
Well, first of all, the one major issue in early Islam was the role of reason. And for a lot of conservative Muslims, which are still echoing very loud today in big parts of the Muslim world, God gave us revelation, reason, it's the end of discussion. And that creates a communalism. So only people who have revelation can be trusted. Only they can have wisdom. So that was one view. Again, very still powerful in many parts of the Muslim world. The other view was that, well, God gave us revelation, but God also gave us reason. And reason is universal. So therefore, people who are not Muslim may also have wisdom. So therefore, maybe we can learn from these people named Aristotle or Plato or other Greek thinkers, which was, of course, important then still as today. Although they're not Muslim, they don't have revelation, but they have reason and they did it well. They practiced it well. So based on that perspective, you had this Aristotelian interest in early Islam, which created a universalistic outlook. And it began with other thinkers like Farabi or Ibn Sina. And there was a rebuttal against them. I mean, they were renounced as heretics because they were buying into the ideas of quote-unquote infidels, right? Hmm. And then came Ibn Rushd. He was kind of defending this Aristotelian tradition, showing that it is not incompatible with belief in Islam. And so that's a huge issue in itself. But I think his emphasis on how do you make arguments and how do you find truth, that there was an interesting emphasis there, which I find relevant to today's discussions. And before that, I mean, let me just say one thing about truth and facts. You know, these terms are used interchangeably most of the time. I think we should make a distinction. An example would be a murder case in a court, right? In a case like that, you know, you will have certain facts. Like somebody got, you know, somebody was found by the police, you know, at 11:45 p.m. dead. And cameras spotted somebody leaving the apartment 5 hours ago. Some fingerprints were found. So these would be facts. But then based on these facts, you're trying to find the truth, which what exactly happened there.
Right.
And then you would have two different interpretations here, probably by the defendant and by the prosecutor. The prosecutor would say, this person murdered. And the his defendant would say, no, 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 that's not the case. You had two different versions. And there are no alternative facts here. Facts are facts. Mm. But there can be alternatively cherry-picked facts. One person can, you know, try to hide the facts. The other person can try to see all the facts. Or how do you interpret the facts is the key issue here. Now, therefore, I think there are no alternative facts, but there are facts in the world. But how do we interpret them is key. And here, Ibn Rushd brought a three-layered explanation of argument, three different kinds of argument. And I think that is interesting. He said, first of all, a lot of people have this argumentative level, which he called rhetorical. What is rhetorical? Rhetorical is like you have this powerful speech, you make a case, you refer to some facts, but you also appeal to emotions. The analogy to that would be today a sermon in a mosque or a church or some person with a very clear view on talk radio or, you know, saying that.
Or the campaign trail.
Yeah, I mean, somebody who's very opinionated and just making this powerful case, and that's rhetorical. So for Ibn Rushd, this was the lowest level of argumentation. So a higher level than that, he said, is dialectical. What is dialectical? In dialectical argumentation, you have two different points of view. So you have one rhetoric here, the other rhetoric there, and they're kind of tit for tat making arguments against each other. This is, of course, better because you're not only hearing the propaganda of one side, you're hearing the propaganda of the other side as well. That's better. That's like having two very opinionated people on TV, you know, talking heads, at least, you know, exchanging opinions. So that was a better level.
Mm-hmm.
But the third level, Ibn Rushd, which he said, you know, and he said few people do that and philosophers do that. And of course, he himself was a philosopher. And he said that is demonstrative. What is that? Well, that is a very careful, painstaking evaluation of all the available facts and a very methodological analysis of those facts so that ultimately you can demonstrate a position. Of course, somebody can make another argument, but, you know, they have to at least struggle with what you do. And that would be, I think, I mean, earlier on the show, I heard the term evidence-based knowledge.
Mm.
I mean, that would be today a scholarly approach, a fair, nonpartisan take on data and facts and trying to, you know, honestly come to a position. So, and for Ibn Rushd, that was the highest level of argumentation and that was the most valuable. And I think we shouldn't lose that in the modern world today, because I think in the midst of all the rhetorical arguments and sometimes rhetorics fighting each other and dialectical, and of course, we might find one rhetoric emotionally appealing, we might go for that, but we shouldn't lose the importance of demonstrative argumentation.
But of course, what you're saying here is that I suppose if Ibn Rushd were around right now, he would look around and see that most of our communication, most of our culture is experienced in that rhetorical argumentation mode, like the lowest form that he would say. Like, that's all politics. It's a lot of, as you were saying, perhaps what's heard in churches or mosques. It's definitely what's on, you know, digital media. So Mustafa, what does that say about sort of where we are today? I mean, like, let's go to the lessons portion of this hour. What lessons should we draw about how we grapple with what truth is today?
Well, you're absolutely right. Ibn Rushd would be very disappointed today. He was disappointed in his time. And I should add that, I mean, despite his great ideas, his books in Arabic on philosophy were burnt in Cordoba, and he himself was banished and sent into exile because the conservatives of its time, you know, condemned him for heresy, quote unquote. Luckily, he survived, but, you know, he was mostly wiped out from the Islamic memory. Interestingly, his books survived in Latin and Hebrew and had more impact on Europe rather than the Muslim world in itself. And that's an irony of history. If he were living today, he would say, and of course, Ibn Rushd had this perspective, even that three-layered argument had some roots in the Greek philosophy. So it was a kind of elitist take of his time. But if he looked at today, he would be, again, see a lot of rhetorical argument out there. And let's not condemn rhetorical arguments. They are there. They're part of human nature. Sometimes rhetorical arguments can point the truth too, but they're not tested. So to be able to come to a conclusion, a fair-minded and objective conclusion on some point, you should not just give yourself to one rhetorical argument. And I think rhetorical arguments, typically what they do is they rely on facts. I mean, every argumentation level here relies on facts, but they cherry pick facts. I can find three things here and make a conspiracy theory based on that. And that conspiracy theory might appeal to the emotions of this social segment in society, and they might be motivated and rallied by that. But we know that, I mean, these things are misleading, and also they lead to a lot of terrible things. I mean, that creates hate, that creates division. Especially rhetorical arguments are good when they make people good about themselves. I mean, they're successful. And they can do that by boosting ego, pumping hatred and division. Whereas a demonstrative person should come out and say, wait, you're cherry-picking facts here. If you look at all the facts, it's not like that. Yeah. So I think we are losing that fairness, level-headed, you know, serious expertise, which we shouldn't. And I think Ibn Rushd was warning about that in the world of Islam. He turned out to be quite right in his warnings at the time. And today, I think it's still an important warning.
So Joel Christensen, you've been patiently listening here with me to the fascinating analysis that Mustafa is giving us. So let's bring back your expertise in classical studies here. What do you hear that resonates with you? Well,
what I hear that resonates that's not at all surprising to me is the idea that reason can give us access to the truth. Right. And it's no accident that there's similarity here, because in a way, Aristotle and Plato and Xenophanes, they were monotheists. Right. They had this basic idea that there can't actually be multiple forms of divinity, because then there would be multiple forms of authority and multiple forms of truth. And so early on, and even pre-Platonic philosophy and then later Platonic philosophy, you had the basic assertion, if there's going to be one truth, if there's going to be one thing in the world we can rely on, there can be only one access to it. Right? And so that's really sort of a core debate. So I do appreciate that. And you can see that that's one of the sort of common touchstones in the Mediterranean faiths that I think we lose sight of. Is that basic fact that we have fundamentalists on every side who are about revelation. But we do have core groups in every major religion that's also about the gift of reason and how that gives us access to the truth, right? Because it can't just be emotion, because how would we have all these different groups laying claim to it? And so another thing that Mustafa brings up that I think is important is the idea of rhetoric and dialectic.
Yeah.
Right? Because he's certainly right. One of the things we struggle with in teaching students at the university level is they lack what we call informational literacy. Right? It's very hard to distinguish between what's true or not true or what's good knowledge or bad information online or on television at all. And why is that? Right? And I think part of it is a failure in the way we design our educational systems. Earlier you talked about narrative and story. Every persuasive commercial you'll see is a story you either don't want to be part of or are part of, or that pulls you into some sort of value system. Right? And the problem is that we're not trained on rhetoric or dialectic. We're not trained to think about the truth in a certain way. And that's the only thing we can actually do. Right, so if I think Mustafa's, you're right on in identifying this problem with rhetoric, right? But I think then if we can identify the problem, we have a certain responsibility to think about what do we do about the problem.
So we just have 2 minutes left, and honestly, we could do the whole series this week just on the topics that we've covered today. So Mustafa, just take 1 minute here to help us wrap up. A question I'm going to be asking continuously throughout the week is, okay, so given what we just heard, sort of what's a key tool that listeners should take with them on our understanding of truth? Is part of it that that questions about it and what it is have been with us for as long as humankind has existed? I mean, what's the key tool you think listeners should take away here?
I think the key tool is to recognize that any rhetoric that makes us feel good about ourselves, excites us, might not be true in itself. And there, especially in the age of propaganda, in four corners of the world, nationalist, xenophobic, hateful, or sometimes triumphalist propaganda. We are human. We're not machines. We have emotions and they're valid and legitimate. But something just feels right to me from my political perspective might not be the objective reality, might not be the objective truth. And therefore, we'll have our emotions, we'll have our positions, but we should give, I think, we should have a respect for objectivity. And that objectivity is universal. I mean, science is universal. I mean, whatever culture you're coming from, there might be some facts about the world. Like the world is, the moon is rotating around the earth and not the other way around. And those things matter. And I think we should have more respect for data, for facts and so on, and just not get into this mood which says, well, I feel that way and that's it.
So feelings are not facts. I've absolutely heard that before. Joel Christensen, I've got 30 seconds to ask you the same question.
We're not born with a user's guide to the mind and the body. And I think one thing I would say is that part of our gift of being alive and having the access to reason is that we assemble one for ourselves. And so I take Mustafa's advice definitely and then, just add to it. If something merely makes you feel like you belong, if you like it, ask yourself why. Why are you attracted to a thing? Why do you believe it? And then give others the benefit of the doubt. Hope that they'll ask the same thing about themselves and on your behalf, too.
Well, Joel Christensen, professor of classical studies at Brandeis University, thank you so much for helping us kick off this series.
Thank you for having me.
And Mustafa Akyol, senior fellow at the Cato Institute. Mustafa, thank you as well.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
And tomorrow, we're going to delve into the neuroscience of truth and what's actually going on in your brain when you think you are perceiving something that is true. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.